His Grace Mahavishnu Prabhuji, and I would hand over the call to Mamta Mataji to give introduction about Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna, Dhanam, Shrila Prabhupada, Shrila Gurudev. Thank you so much, everyone, and thank you so much, Mahavishnu Prabhuji, for giving us Bhagavatam class today. Kindly allow me to give some introduction about you. Mahavishnu Prabhuji is a disciple of late Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj, lived and grew up in India from the age of 10, where he attended a traditional Vedic Gurukul school for the following 15 years. In addition to secular studies, Prabhuji also learned to read and write Sanskrit, became fluent in the local language, and completed in-depth studies and courses in Vedic philosophy and culture, Yoga Siddhanta, Bhakti and Hinduism. Prabhuji received Diksha initiation in 1990 at the age of 17, receiving the name Mahavishnu. Just 2 years later, he was ordained as Vaishnava Hindu priest in the Bhakti lineage of Brahma Madhava Gaudiya Sampradaya of the four Vaishnava Bhakti Sampradayas. This Sampradaya includes illustrious personalities as Vedvyas, the sage credited with compiling the voluminous Vedic texts, Madhvacharya, who is famous for the refutation of Shankaracharya's Advaita philosophy, and A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, founder of ISKCON and prodigious author of Bhakti Yoga literature. After years of teaching Vedic philosophy in India, Prabhuji moved to Norway, where he lived for 2 years, serving the Bhakti Yogis of Scandinavia and continued his spiritual coaching and teaching. Upon his return to the United States, Prabhuji served ISKCON's Boston Temple in various capacities, from head priest to vice president and president. And after completing his ISKCON services, Prabhuji and his wife opened a new Bhakti Mandir in Worcester, Massachusetts, where he continues to train and empower others in Bhakti Yoga. Thank you so much, Prabhuji. Please take over the call and forgive me if I got any information wrong about you. Thank you, Prabhuji.
Thank you very much. I want to thank both you, Mamta Mataji, and Shyama Gauri Mataji for inviting me. I hope my connection is working for everyone to hear what I'm saying. I'm just getting over a cold, so my throat is a little scratchy. Please forgive. So let's get right to it, I suppose. A Chanakya mantras for invocation before we go into the Bhagavad Gita, of course. Om Jnana Tamiram Visya Jnanam Jnana Shalakaya Chakshuram Anitam Yanatasmai Shri Guru Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhisam Sthapitam Yana Bhutala Swayam Rupati Dhamayam Vidhati Swapadam Tidam Om Nama Om Vishnu Padhaya Krishna Krishnaya Bhutala Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shanyavadi Prashchati Heshutayine. You can all chant with me if you'd like. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayana Namaskritim Naram Chaiva Narottamam Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Tatojam Udherayat Nasta Payeshu Bhadreshu Nityam Bhagavati Sevaya Bhagavati Timashloki Bhakti Bhavati Naishtiti. So we're continuing on. This is my first attendance to this program, and I must really say it's very, very inspiring, actually. I never attended a Bhagavatam class in this manner, or a Japa class, for that matter. It was really, really inspiring. I called in a little early at 6 o'clock, and I was able to chant for about a half an hour with all of you. And this is a really, really wonderful 21st century approach to Krishna consciousness. So we're reading from Canto 4, Chapter 2, Text 20. I'll read the Sanskrit and just go from there. Vidyaya shapam virishani granir nandishvaroru sakushaya dushita dushaya shapam vishasharja tarunum yechanava motam staravachatam dija. Word for word. Vidyaya, understanding, Shapam, the curse, Girisha of Shiva, Anuga Agrani, one of the principal associates, Nandishwara, Nandishwar, Rosha, anger, Koshaya, red, Dushita, blinded, Dakshaya, two Daksha, Shapam, the curse, Visasarja, gave, Darunam, harsh, ye, who, cha, and Anvamodan, tolerated, Tat, Abachitam, the cursing of Shiva, Dvija, Brahmanas. Translation. Upon understanding that Lord Shiva had been cursed, Nandishwar, one of Lord Shiva's principal associates, became greatly angry. His eyes became red, and he prepared to curse Daksha and all the Brahmanas. He prepared to curse Daksha and all the Brahmanas present there who had tolerated Daksha's cursing Shiva in harsh words. Purport. There is a long-standing dissension among some of the neophyte Vaishnavas and Shaivites. They are always at loggerheads. When Daksha cursed Lord Shiva in harsh words, some of the Brahmanas present might have enjoyed it, because some Brahmanas do not very much admire Lord Shiva. This is due to the ignorance of Lord Shiva's position. Nandishwar was affected by the cursing, but he did not follow the example of Lord Shiva, who is also present there. Although Lord Shiva could also have cursed Daksha in a similar way, he was silent and tolerant. But Nandishwar, his follower, was not tolerant. Of course, as a follower, it was right for him not to tolerate an insult to his master, but he should not have cursed the Brahmanas who were present. The entire issue was so complicated that those who were not strong enough to forget their positions, forgot their positions, and thus cursing and counter-cursing went on in that great assembly. In other words, the material field is so unsteady that even personalities like Nandishwar, Daksha, and many of the Brahmanas present were infected by the atmosphere of anger. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. I was reading earlier, yesterday evening, when I was going through this particular chapter, and in the first text of this chapter, it describes how Daksha, due to his envious nature of Lord Shiva, was bewildered and he began to say all kinds of unfortunate things to Lord Shiva. We see here Nandishwar becomes overwhelmed with anger and also begins to get involved in his cursing and counter-cursing. A few verses from today, you will read that there was more envy involved and other people would get involved due to the envious nature of Lord Shiva. So we're addressing here in this particular chapter the issue, or many issues, but one that we can actually focus on is the issues of anger, envy, and these types of enemies. Actually, we know that there's the Arishadvargas, right? The six enemies of the human being: Kam, Krodh, Lobha, Moha, Mada, and Matsarya, right? Lust, anger, greed, delusion, arrogance, and envy. So these six Arishadvargas plague the living entity, and we see very much so here that even great personalities like Nandishwar and Daksha are being influenced by these Arishadvargas, Matsarya, envy, anger, and so on. Not taking the example of Lord Shiva, who was tolerating these types of insults by Lord Daksha. But let's really try to understand how, I'm not going to get into the detriment of these particular qualities, how anger is bad, how lust is bad, how envy is bad. We all know this. Let's instead investigate where these come from and how we can be rid of them. We know from the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, right? Jayate Vishnam Pumsa Sangasti Shippa Jayate Sangyatsan Jayate Kama Kama Kurvati Jayate. Through contemplation, Jayate, we develop an attachment, right? From such attachment, Krishna says, lust develops, and from lust, anger arises. In the following verse, Krishna says, from anger, complete delusion arises, and from delusion, bewilderment of memory. When memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost. When intelligence is lost, one falls down again into the material pool. This material pool, of course, is samsara, right? The cycle of birth and death, taking one birth after another. In other words, experiencing what Daksha is going to experience, have his head cut off and be replaced by the head of a goat. So, not to take it lightly, but that is the path that this eventually leads, where we fall down into the material pool and end up with the head of a goat. That's putting it in no uncertain terms. But it starts with, right, we're talking about anger here. This chapter is a lot about anger being taking over the assembly. Before there was anger, the verse, by the way, is chapter 2, text 62 and 63. For those of you who don't know, look it up. It's a very wonderful read. Before anger, there was lust, right? This desire for enjoyment. When we're unable to receive, when we're unable to experience enjoyment, we become angry, right? We desire something, we don't get it, we become angry. Or we get what we want, and it's taken away from us. Many of us here in the United States, we've just done our taxes, right? Our hard-earned time and money has been taken away by the government, right? That's just the nature of things. So we become a little despondent that the government takes away our hard-earned luxury that we could use for more productive things than all kinds of foolishness that the government uses it for, right? So this is what we're attached to, our results of our labor. The government takes it away, we become angry, right? Despondent, resentful, frustrated. So there's anger. Before anger, there is this lust, desires. Before desire, there's attachment. Listening to the verse of Krishna as he describes, there's attachment. Attachment develops in lust and anger. So this attachment becomes attached. What are we becoming attached to, right? We're becoming attached to Dhyayata Vishayam Pumsa. We become attached to the things on which we contemplate. Prabhupada translates it quite wonderfully when he says, while contemplating the objects of the senses, the person develops attachment. From such attachment, lust, and from such lust, anger arises. When we contemplate the objects of the senses, we develop an attachment. So essentially, anger is an attachment revealed. When we become angry, when we experience frustration and resentment, that is indicative of a latent attachment. Somewhere within our hearts, there is an attachment. It is an attachment maybe to our reputation. It is an attachment to money. It can be an attachment to an idea. That is a very insidious type of attachment. Sometimes we think, oh, it's just money. We can always get more money. Or we think it's easy to recognize attachments to physical things. But it's not so easy to always recognize attachments to ideas that we hold. But we can be very attached to specific ideas, right? Those of us who have lived in temples before, and we have to work with other devotees, we have to work with other people, we have to work with temple managers, and we are attached to a certain way of seeing things, a certain way of managing things, and we get into issues with others, right? Those of us who are married, right? We see one way of... It was just my wife and I a few days ago, we were preparing some prasadam for the mandir, the temple that I have in here in Massachusetts. We were preparing some prasadam. my wife is from Turkey, so she was preparing a Turkish dish. The first time I had had this Turkish dish was actually in Turkey. And she had all the traditional ingredients for that particular dish in Turkey. We did not have that here. So we were arguing of what we could substitute for the particular ingredients of this particular dish. And of course, she had her way of saying, and I was thinking, because I, by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada, I grew up in Gurukul and I learned how to cook in India. So I had my idea of how we could substitute some things for the preparation. So you can imagine. The point is, we are attached to ideas as well. But before this attachment, there is a contemplation of the sense objects. And Krishna is saying, Dhyayata, we know from the, I'm going to digress a bit. In Ashtanga Yoga, the eight steps of the eight parts to Ashtanga Yoga. One of the parts, one of the steps is dhyana. Dhyana means concentration. Before dhyana, there is a step that's called dharana. Dharana is the beginning of actual meditation. The example of dharana is when you have water mixed with sand. Honey mixed with sand. When you have honey mixed with sand and you try to pour it, obviously it doesn't pour very well, right? When you have dirt and gravel and sand mixed in a jar of honey, you try to pour that honey, it falls out of the pitcher in large clumps, right? So in dharana, our concentration is like that. It comes, it goes, it's in large clumps, it's not stable. The next step is dhyana. Dhyana is when our concentration is like honey mixed with water. When you dilute honey with water and you pour it, at least you get a single stream, right? Not like when you have honey mixed with sand and debris. At least when you have honey mixed with water, you get a single stream. So that is dhyana. Our concentration is at least somewhat focused. However, it can be blown. When the air blows, right, it breaks the stream of water, and the water splatters. The final step is samadhi. That is when you have undiluted, pure honey, and when you pour this honey, it falls in a single, unbroken stream and does not splatter. That is samadhi. So when Krishna describes contemplation, he uses the term dhyana. When we have a relatively focused idea of a focus on the sense objects. Now, this is where the Bhagavatam class actually begins. I've said everything in the past 10 minutes to lead to this particular point. And that is, why are we focused on the sense objects? This is where everything falls apart. This is where it becomes unfair. We are focused on the sense object because we are the living entity, the jivatma, the soul. We are anandamaya vyasat. We are anandamaya. We are pleasure-seeking by nature. It is our inherent quality to seek pleasure, happiness, satisfaction. We are anandamaya. The problem is that for lifetimes, we have been engaged in trying to fulfill this or deal with this, our quality of being anandamaya, through the agency of the material senses. In fact, the moment we were born, our entire childhood, from our very infancy, we have been trying to satisfy the senses. And in fact, when my youngest daughter was born, right? Many of you, I'm sure, may have children. They have a temper tantrum. And they're screaming, they're crying, they're yelling, and all you want to do is to get them to stop. And of course, what do? You put a sweet in their mouth. Or you give them something to distract them. In other words, we try to satisfy their senses. Of course, as an adult, we learn how to satisfy our senses, but only in a more sophisticated manner. That's all. That's the only difference between an adult and a child. Adults satisfy their senses in a more sophisticated manner. The point is that we're always trying to satisfy the senses. We're always trying to get hold of the sense objects. We are therefore contemplating the sense objects. We are anandamaya. Our problem is that we only know how to experience happiness through the material senses. Now, this causes a very, very big problem. Because after lifetime, the only way we have known how to cater to or experience pleasure, we are pleasure-seeking. So the only way we know to experience pleasure is through the material senses. Now, there's a problem. The problem is, when we try to satisfy the material senses, what happens? Attachment, lust, anger. From anger, complete delusion arises. From delusion, bewilderment of the memory. There is a deteriorate spiral. We go down again into the material pool, and we end up with the head of a goat. That is entirely unfair, is it not? Here I am, Jivatma, I am Anandamaya. I'm going to seek after pleasure. I'm going to seek satisfaction. But yet when I try to do so, I end up with a goat's head. That is unfair. This is because the only way I know how to fulfill this Anandamaya quality is through the senses. That's the problem. Ahanka, the ego, says, Mahavishnu, you are Anandamaya. You want to experience satisfaction and happiness? Go through the senses. And from this, this Anandamaya, contaminated or conditioned by Ahankar, we get a particular principle. This principle is called Ahammameti, right? Janasya Mahoyam Ahammameti. We'll come across this verse in the fifth canto in the teachings of Lord Vrishabhadeva. He says, people are completely delusioned by this principle, Ahammameti. Ahammameti means I and mine. So this Anandamaya, this quality, our inherent nature of seeking pleasure, when conditioned by Ahankara, equals Ahammameti, I and mine. How can I satisfy my senses? This is where Ahammameti comes from. It is this Ahammameti that then forces us or has us chasing the sense objects, contemplating the sense objects, becoming attached to the sense objects, striving after the sense objects, becoming angry when we do not receive the sense objects as we like, or our sense objects are taken away. Then anger comes delusion, and so on and so on and so forth. So it is Ahammameti, this princess mentality of I and mine. So now I've talked about the first half. Let me look at the time here. 11 minutes to go. So we've looked at this, the one side. Anger, envy, where all this is coming from. And we see the story in of Daksha. He has this principle, this mentality of Ahammameti. He's upset because his daughter has married Lord Shiva. So he becomes angry and envious of Lord Shiva because he wants his daughter to be married to a prestigious person. And in his eyes, Lord Shiva does not look or seem in any way prestigious. So Daksha is completely caught up in the Ahammameti. There's the other story in the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam of Brahma. You know the story very well. He has his four sons, the four Kumaras. And the four Kumaras are only interested in spiritual life. But however, Lord Brahma, who's just beginning the creation of the universe, he doesn't need sannyasis and brahmacharis to preach. He needs doctors, lawyers, and engineers, right, to help create the universe. So he's trying to get his sons to go to school, get a degree, and help get a job and build the universe, essentially. I'm obviously using these terms so we can more readily identify with what's going on here. But his four sons say no. Brahma becomes furious. He becomes completely conditioned by Ahammameti. You are my sons. You are to do what I tell you to do. So this Ahammameti, this mentality of Ahammameti, is the problem. Now that we've understood where the problem begins and lies, how do we solve it? How do we deal with it? How do we address it? This proprietorship, Ahammameti, is the problem. We have to transform this mentality of proprietorship, this mentality of Ahammameti, we have to transform it into stewardship. Transformation from proprietorship to stewardship. Transformation from Ahammameti to Dasosmi. Dasosmi is I am the servant. This is stewardship. It means I am the caretaker. I am the steward of all that I am dealing with. I do not have proprietorship ownership over this. I am the steward. We have to switch from this mentality of proprietorship to stewardship. Now the question then becomes, how do we do this? Love. That is the only way to do it. Bhakti, love. That is the only way we can transform this mentality of Ahammameti to Dasosmi, love. I was giving a, we also in the temple that we have now, I started Gurukul. So we have Gurukul 2 days a week. Kids come. We have about 15 students now. On Wednesdays and Sundays, they come and we have Gurukul class. Teach them mantra, yajna, puja, so on and so forth. Right? Recently, we've been doing the 10 incarnations of Vishnu. And Nrisimhadev's appearance day is coming up, so we were talking about Lord Nrisimhadev. And I was explaining, obviously, the story to them, and I did not go so much into the philosophy because some of them are young. We have a few older students, a few 16-year-olds, but most of them are in their 10, 11 years old. So it's mostly this, just the story, and a little bit of philosophy will come later. But we are adults here among us, so we can actually unpack the story of Lord Nrisimhadev a little bit more. The story of Lord Nrisimhadev is a very interesting story, and we know this, but just to drive home the point. The story of Lord Nrisimhadev and Prahlad Maharaj, it is not a story of protection. It is not a story of the Supreme Personality of Godhead protecting his devotees and appearing to protect his devotees. Hiranyakashipu was trying to burn Prahlad, throw him off the cliff, trying to have him poisoned and trampled by elephants. None of it happened, because Prahlad was already protected before Lord Nrisimhadev appeared. Prahlad Maharaj was already protected. The appearance of Lord Nrisimhadev has nothing to do with protecting Prahlad. The appearance of Lord Nrisimhadev is about love. The story of Lord Nrisimhadev is the world's greatest love story ever told. Imagine this. Think of it. Vishnu is in Vaikuntha, happily engaged in whatever they do in Vaikuntha, right? With Lakshmi Devi there, all of the associates there, they're having a good time in Vaikuntha. Prahlad Maharaj is perfectly protected. And is Vishvakshena. Vishvakshena is the secretary of the commander-in-chief of Lord Vishnu. Vishvakshena comes and says, "My dear Lord Vishnu, we have a problem." "What is it?" Lord Vishnu says. "Well, Prahlad Maharaj is down there, and he's Hiranyakashipu is causing some difficulty." And Vishnu says, "No problem. Prahlad Maharaj is all automatically protected." "Well, yes," Vishvakshena says. "However, there's Prahlad Maharaj has said that you live in a pillar, a marble pillar, and Hiranyakashipu wants to try to prove that you don't reside in a marble pillar. So can you please come down and take a peer out of this marble?" That's the story of Prahlad Maharaj. The story of Prahlad Maharaj is Nrisimhadev appeared from the pillar because Prahlad Maharaj said he would. That is the appearance of Lord Nrisimhadev. Hiranyakashipu asked Prahlad Maharaj, "Is he in this pillar?" Prahlad Maharaj, "Of course the Lord is in this pillar." So what does the Lord have to do? Because of the love Lord Nrisimhadev has for Prahlad Maharaj, he crawls inside a pillar. When I went to Gurukula in India, this was in the early 80s. I had just arrived in Vrindavan, Gurukula. And I'm running a little short of time, but the story is always a good thing. I just arrived in Gurukula in India, and I was new there. But I had some friends. I had just arrived from America, and some of my friends from the Gurukuls I attended in America were also there in Vrindavan. So we were, I was hanging out with them and trying to, you know, make friends and such. I was about 9 or 10 years old. That's irrelevant. But anyways. And so I was meeting, you know, developing friendships, and somehow we got into this discussion about whose mom that's the way children are, whose mom cooks the best, right? So we were saying, "My mom cooks better than your mom, and my dad can be your dad," and all that kind of thing. So somehow we got around to, you know, we're having this discussion, and I said, "Well, my mom makes the best apple samosas." And we got into an argument about the best apple samosas. And I was saying, "No, my mom makes the best apple samosas." So my mom had actually brought me to Vrindavan Gurukul and made sure I had settled in. So she was still in Vrindavan at the time. And the boy said, "No, your mom can't. My mom makes it better." So I went running, crying to my mom, kind of like Dhruva crying to Suniti, right? I would cry to my mom, Mom, they say you don't make nice apple samosas. Can you make nice apple samosas for everybody? And she said, sure, no problem. And she made over 150 apple samosas for all the kids of Bandulakula. Now, I did not know this until many years later. I did not recognize or understand this until many years later. This was the first time that both my mom and I had ever left the United States. My mother had never been to India. She had no idea how, and this is the early 80s. In Vrindavan Gurukul at the time, the stoves were run by wood. My mother was used to gas and electric. She had no idea how to shop for apples. She had no idea how to, because she had never seen, I mean, those of you may know that in India, when they cook for large quantities, they have these large karais, these woks, right? Huge, enormous woks. My mother had never seen anything of that size before. And the spoons were the size of paddles for boats. She had never experienced anything like this. It took my mother 3 days to arrange for the cooking of all of these apple turnovers, all of these apple samosas. But all I knew was my mom was going to cook apple samosas for the entire school of 150 kids. Of course, she let me know exactly how that went many years later. But of course, she did it because of love. Back to the point is we transfer or transform a hammameti to dasosmi through love, through bhakti. It is this transformation. We have this transformation from a hammameti to dasosmi, from proprietorship to stewardship. We actually gain much more satisfaction. When there is love involved, then we can be a steward. My sister, she was here, it's about 4 or 5 years ago. I returned to the United States, and I was visiting my sister, and she wanted me to, she was going away, she wanted me to take care of her house and her car. Now I have a wonderful relationship with my sister, and I wanted to make sure her car was taken care of. So while she was away, I took her car, I cleaned her car, I gave it a checkup. I took great, great care of her car so that when she came back, her car would be completely taken care of, all repairs were made, and she would have basically a fresh, almost new car that she could have. This is because of love. Now, if you were to see my personal car, well, I wait to the last minute to do the maintenance required, right? That's just the way it is. Now, of course, as they say, ownership turns sand to gold because of this principle of hammameti, based on what I can get for the satisfaction of my senses. When there is love and stewardship, we actually invest far more in the things around us, when we see everything around us as properties of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But that does not matter if there is no love. So there must be a loving connection with Krishna in order for us to see the world as Krishna and to act as stewards. Because remember, I must come back to this point. And it's 8 o'clock. I must come back to this point as I begin to wrap up. And we'll have some questions. We are aham brahmasmi. We are pleasure seekers. If we do not begin to experience satisfaction from our devotional activities, we are going to revert back to chasing after sense objects. When we transform our mentality from proprietorship to stewardship through love, then we gain satisfaction. It's called premananda, the joy, the ecstasy of love. When we have that ecstasy of love, that connection of love to Krishna, then we see everything in relation to Krishna. We see our children in relation to Krishna. We see our husband in relation to children, our wife, our spouse in relation to Krishna. And when we see everything in relation to Krishna, and the only way we can do this is when there is love for Krishna. When there is love, then we can behave and act as stewards. When there is not love, we cannot act as stewards, and we act as proprietors. When we act as proprietors, ahammamati sets in. When ahammamati sets in, we begin to see things according to our sense objects, what satisfies our sense objects. We are pleasure-seeking. And this is why through love, through bhakti, we experience premananda, and we act as stewards. We relate to everyone as stewards. These particular, my wife is connected to Krishna. I have, there's that, many of you may know that my wife is, and I were actually watching this movie earlier this year. What was it called? I forget the Hindi. Rab Banerjee Jyoti. Forgive my pronunciation. Funny movie. It's don't take it seriously, but it is a funny movie, right? Shah Rukh Khan and some other actors. And one asked, one very important point that I got from the movie was they were trying to see, it's a husband and wife couple, they were trying to see, or the phrase was to see God in the other person. Right? It is a very profound idea to see Krishna in our spouse, to see Krishna in our children, to see Krishna in our boss, to see Krishna in our obnoxious neighbor. And then recognize, because Krishna says, yayatam mam prapadyante, right? All living entities surrender unto you on their path in all respects. All living entities are connected to Krishna in some way. Krishna is within the heart of every living entity. But we don't see this, and that is the problem. When we have a loving connection with Krishna, we begin to see Krishna everywhere. When we see Krishna everywhere, then when I'm arguing with my spouse over a Turkish preparation that we're trying to cook, I see her connected to Krishna. I think, I am a steward. I am here to serve her. I'm here to help her. I'm here to do whatever I can so that her service is increased. And in that mentality, my love, my joy also increases. But there has to be love in connection with Krishna. Final point, and then we'll go into questions and answers. How do we develop that? Well, it's the final point, but it's the most important point. How do we develop that love for Krishna? Prahlad Maharaj said, Shravanam Chaitanam Vishnu Smadhanam Parasevaram Arjanam Vandanam Dasyam Sakyam Atmani Vedanam. But let's start with the first one, Shravanam. Hear about Krishna. Hear. This is a wonderful program, I believe Shamagori Mataji put together, where we hear the glories of Krishna every day. It is not a coincidence that Srila Prabhupada, before he translated the entire Bhagavatam, he translated the Krishna book first. I think when he was up to the second canto, he jumped to the tenth canto and said, no, I want to translate the Krishna book, the tenth canto, into English, because if I die, it won't be there. He wanted to get the stories of Krishna, Krishna Leela, make that available, because by hearing, we become attracted to Krishna. The more we hear about Krishna, we become attracted to Krishna. A natural love begins to develop within Krishna. But it has to be regular. It has to be consistent. And then kirtanam, chanting, glorifying Krishna, sharing about Krishna to others. I'll end on this last point, actually a story. This is actually again in Vrindavan Gurukul. I was young at the time. No, this was in the Mayapur Gurukul, because it was in Srila Prabhupada's Samadhi. We were chanting, it was shortly after Prabhupada's Samadhi was complete. And we were chanting in Prabhupada's Samadhi. And, well, the way it happened was that the ashram teacher has his group of children, and 10 or 15 of them, and we sit with him and we chant. I was in my early teens at the time, and I was not so much interested in chanting. So the rule was you didn't have to chant if you didn't want to chant, but you had to sit there quietly and not disturb those boys around who were chanting. So I was sitting there exercising my right not to chant, And my teacher was not very inspiring, so I was going on like this for many months. And it was no fault of my teacher. I'm not going to blame him. But I will say this. I had actually moved to another ashram. The ashram change had happened, and I had a new ashram teacher. And I sat there with my new ashram teacher, determined to exercise my right not to chant. And towards the end, he said, well, you know, Mahavishnu, my name wasn't Mahavishnu at the time. My name was Vyasadeva before I was initiated. It was Vyasadeva. Why aren't you chanting? I said, I don't want to. It doesn't work for me. You know, I'm not, you know, I don't want to chant. So he sat with me for a while, and we were talking about it, and he was saying, well, you know, Mahavishnu, don't chant for Krishna. Chant with Krishna. And he said, what do you mean? He says, chant with Krishna. Imagine that Krishna is sitting beside you, just like all these boys are sitting beside you. Have Krishna sitting beside you on your right-hand side, and you and Krishna are chanting your rounds together. I must tell you, to this day, that it has been one of the most illuminating and enlightening instructions I've ever had about chanting japa. After that conversation, from that point till today, my japa has been transformed. I chant my japa with Krishna. Krishna and I chant japa together. And that has grown not just from my japa, it's grown from everything. And what I do, Krishna walks with me. Krishna is with me. So it just changed, and this works for me. It may not work for everybody, but it works for me. It makes Krishna a part of everything that I do in my life. When I go to work, I go to work with Krishna. Now, of course, obviously, I do not always have Krishna on my mind. He's not always with me. In that sense, I don't always carry that awareness of Krishna by my side. But that practice of having that awareness of Krishna by my side has made me appreciate and grow that love for Krishna. It helps me appreciate and to move from a proprietorship mentality to a stewardship mentality. Because now Krishna and I are doing this together. Krishna and I are going to this meeting together. Krishna and I are going to deal with this issue together. It keeps me in the mindset of stewardship. It keeps a loving bond between me and Krishna, so I remain in the mindset of stewardship. I will end there. We have gone over time and entertain and deal with some questions, if there are any.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Very, very wonderful class and very nicely. I like the way you said, don't chant for Krishna, chant with Krishna. It's really amazing, and you really need to be humble and make a daso feel like that. It's really amazing. Thank you. I request all the devotees, if they have any question or comments for Puji, they can go ahead.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Dandat Pranam, Srila Prabhupada Ji, Mamta here. I really want to thank you for the wonderful class, and the examples that you gave are wonderful, and I could relate to some of them. And then I realized the problems, you know, that happens is because of the as you said, you know, we are attached to the ideas. So mostly, you know, the problems which I have in my life, you know, sometimes with everyone is just because of that, you know, attachment to the ideas. I never thought it that way. So, you know, henceforth, if I think I'm going to apply that and see if, you know, I can have less problems. And all your other examples were wonderful, Prabhuji. Thank you so much.
Thank you both for having me. I really appreciate this. This is a wonderful service you put together.
Thank you, Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Thank you very much. Very nicely you have explained. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Chanting with Krishna and doing all the activities with Krishna. Wonderful. Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji, Dandavat Pranam, all Guru Srila Prabhupada and Gurudev. Thank you very much for a wonderful class. Jai Jai Shri Radhe Shyam.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Okay, well, I want to give my last time to thank Shyama Gauri Mataji and Mamta Mataji for inviting me and allowing me to do this particular service and sharing what few realizations I have on my slow growth in Krishna and Bhakti Yoga. So thank you both very, very much, Matajis.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. I have a question. This chapter has the title Daksha Curses Lord Shiva. Reading this chapter, I still did not understand what kind of curse he is giving to Lord Shiva. Like the four Kumaras, they curse Jai Vijaya and they have to take birth and become Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha, like that. So, In this chapter, what kind of curse Daksha Prajapati is giving to Lord Shiva?
I don't remember a specific curse to Lord Shiva in the sense that he is saying, cursing Shiva that he's going to take birth in some particular form or anything like that. The way I understand the translation, because cursing, as we know, even the English term cursing, it can be just shouting bad language, right? Swearing. Maybe another way of saying swearing, curse words, right? So maybe Daksha, as far as I know, Daksha did not say, well, Shiva, may you take birth as like this or like that. But Daksha was swearing at Lord Shiva, calling him all kinds of bad names. So that is my understanding of how Daksha was using curse words, swear words, to describe Lord Shiva. And in the previous verses, prior to this one, the first several verses, if you read in this particular chapter before we come to this particular verse 20, Daksha has some pretty strong words that he's saying to Lord Shiva. He's calling him unclean. He's calling him unfit to be even in the same room as the demigods. So he's really using some very, very harsh language. So it is my understanding that when the term Daksha curses Lord Shiva, he's using curse words. He's swearing at Lord Shiva in the company of all of those assembled there. As far as I know, I do not know of a specific curse in the sense where Daksha says, Shiva, may your arms fall off or something like that. That I do not know of. I certainly have not read it in this particular chapter.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji, please.
Yes.
Pranam. Hare Krishna.
Yes, Mataji, go ahead.
You see, I have heard, and I think I have also read, that Daksha gives a curse. Well, he says that Lord Shiva will not get a share in the yajna, and he won't be worshipped like that. So this is what I have understood. So can you please share some light on it? Thanks. Hare Krishna.
Yes. That is an interesting question, because an interesting point. I've heard that. Did Daksha give that particular curse? Or I'm not quite sure of who made that curse. But I did hear that. Daksha gave that curse.
Yeah.
Okay, if that's what you've read, that's what you heard, then that's what we have done. Then Lord Shiva will not receive any share of the sacrificial offerings.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there we have the answer to the question, Mataji. That is one of the curses that Daksha gave to Lord Shiva, that he would not receive the offerings of the sacrifice.
Thank you, Prabhuji, very much. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. If there's nothing else, then I will graciously take your leave?
Prabhuji, yeah. Please come again.
Yeah.
And I hope to join you in other days and listen to the classes given by other devotees and chant japa with you as well. I'll try to make it a point to attend as much as possible.
And also sometimes give a class. Hare Krishna.
Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you.
Prabhuji, thank you so much. I really like the point you point out, the aham amiti, means how you gave the both explanation, means proprietorship and then I and my, how we can dovetail these things through the devotional service, through the love. That was really, really nice, very enlightenable. Thank you so much for coming and giving your association, Prabhu, in the conference. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you have some time, would like to hear about your subconscious journey, how you came in Krishna consciousness.
All right, can you say that again, please?
We would like to hear about yourself, how you came in Krishna consciousness and meet with Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj.
Oh, okay. Yes, I would certainly like to share that, but can we do that on another day? I do have to head to work now.
Okay. Yeah, some other day. Maybe. Okay.
Yeah, another day. Yeah, another day. I'll make sure I leave time for sharing a little bit of my experience in Krishna consciousness.
Hare Krishna Prabhu, you are telling the proprietorship means how we can, what is the opposite of you were telling? I could not understand 2-3 times I heard from you.
Okay. It's proprietorship and the other was stewardship. It's STEWARD, stewardship.
Oh, stewardship. Okay. I never heard that word, and that's why I was. This is the meaning means. What is that meaning? Stewardship means. Prabhu?
It means to take care of, things, caretaker.
Oh, okay. That's thank you, Prabhu. Just wanted to clarify. Thank you so much.
So thank you all very much. I offer my obeisances. Vanchakalpaturubhya shakripasandubhya heva chapati taram bhavani vaishnavibhya namo namaha. Shri Krishna.